Port from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Pretty Nails, Milo's Restaurant, and McCandless Photography, located next to the post office, still using a traditional film process to create contemporary portraits.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, with an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria now features Sunday dinner with a different and unique menu every week.
You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Jeff Bossert. The producer for the program today is Harriet Williamson. The technical director is Henry Frayne. Our guest this afternoon is Buzz Bissinger. The Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter made waves through his days with the Philadelphia Inquirer and inspired him to write A Prayer for the City, which studies big city life and politics in Philadelphia. He then turned his flair for writing to sports. Bissinger is the author of Friday Night Lights, which chronicles the institution of small-town Texas high school football, and that was adopted into a successful film. Sports Illustrated called Friday Night Lights the best sports book of the past quarter century, and when it was written in 1990. His most recent book is Three Nights in August. It spent many weeks on the top 10 list. It examines the inner workings of a three-game series played between the St. Louis Cardinals and Chicago Cubs. More specifically, it follows the all the moves made by Cardinals manager Tony La Russa during that series in 2003. Good afternoon, Mr. Bissinger.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
Tell me a bit about this series, how this book got lined up. I understand that Tony La Russa had as much or maybe more to do with it than you in making this book possible.
Well, I think initially that's true, and I must say it's a great time to be talking baseball for fans out there. You know, we're a day away from the playoffs. The Cardinals have made it for a second straight year. They'll be playing the San Diego Padres. It was an incredible season if you're a Red Sox fan or a Yankee fan or an Indian fan. And I think that's what this book, Three Nights in August, is about. It's about the timeless beauty of the game, about the exquisite strategy and humanity of the game, why baseball, for all the scandal that surrounds it, is just still a terrific, wonderful, unexpected game. And the genesis, you're exactly right. Tony approached me at the end of 2002. He had been asked for many years to write a book. He did have a profit motive that had nothing to do with him. Tony runs a foundation for the rescue of cats and dogs called ARF, and they just built a brand-new building for $15 million, and Tony is ceaselessly looking for ways to pay off the nut, and he felt he had a lot to say. And I just impulsively said yes. I thought it would be a traditional collaboration, and traditional collaborations can be tough nuts because as a writer you don't have a lot of control, but I love baseball and was always fascinated by Tony. I knew about him. I knew about his background. I knew he was a great and controversial strategist. So I said yes, but as we got into it, it became clear Tony didn't want some boring as told to season in the life book, and I didn't want to do that type of book. So the book really morphed into my own thing and the structure of it to try to find something timeless. It's not a season in the life book. It's a book that takes as its frame a three-game series in 2003 between the St. Louis Cardinals and the Chicago Cubs, and that's the narrative framework for the book.
Glad somebody recognized the greatest rivalry in baseball.
Well, I believe, you know, I'm not going to say it's the biggest rivalry in baseball. I'd be foolish to say that. You know, the Yankees and the Red Sox has taken on a life of its own, but I find something nasty in that rivalry, although it's gotten a little bit better. You know, there's been a lot of sniping between players. There's a lot of beer drinking. There's a lot of screaming. There's a lot of yelling. For those of us who realize there's life outside the East Coast, which there is, you know, Cubs and Cardinals has been an intense, beautiful kind of Midwestern feudal kingdom rivalry for well over a century. They play hard against each other. They play well against each other. It has a great tradition. Chicago is a great baseball town. St. Louis may even be a better baseball town. And so it's a very intense rivalry. But what I liked, there's a purity to it and almost an innocence. St. Louis fans are very loyal to their team, and so are Cubbies fans. And it's just nice to see. You know, it's sports to me at its best, without all the histrionics and screaming and you know, kind of chest thumping that, so much of sports is about. It's just a magnificent rivalry.
I have to admit my allegiance lie in the other dugout during the this. I've been familiar with the series. I'm a longtime Cub fan,
right.
But no, very familiar.
Longtime suffering Cubs fan.
Exactly, but very familiar with this three game series,
sure.
And remember each of the big hits and
right.
But there's so much more that goes into each pitch thrown and where the infielders position themselves and that. Your average fan would care to think about all the video they research, and
right.
And you talked about a lot of that in the book.
Well, I mean, you know, the goal was to, as I say, to try to do something timeless, something that you can read about last year, this year, next year, any year, if you are a baseball fan. And I think you have to be a baseball fan. I'm not going to be a writer who says, well, it's about more than just baseball. It is more than just about baseball, but it's really for the fan to really, as you say, to take the reader really inside the game in a way that perhaps no writer has ever gone, although some have come very close and done it wonderfully well. George Will is one example. Dan Okren wrote a wonderful book called Nine Innings where he dissected a game. But the point is to show to readers that, you know, this is a beautifully magnificent, complex game, and a lot of it is from the vantage point of the manager, in this case Tony La Russa, to really try to give a kind of a really giant window into how his view of the game changes with every pitch. And I think that's what's cool about baseball. It does change with every pitch. You know, there's just so many games within the game of baseball itself. You know, where you position the infield, what kind of lead you take off first base, the cat and mouse between the pitcher and catcher, the way coaches try to steal signs, the way the guy on second base tries to steal signs. You know, what kind of pitch you need to throw in a certain situation, the pregame preparation, which I didn't really know much about, which is almost like football. It just is an exquisite, nuanced, wonderfully strategic game, and that's a big part of the book, taking the reader through that three-game series, literally pitch by pitch, but also to capture, I think, the wonderful, magical, you know, humanity of the game of baseball.
I want to remind listeners we'll be taking calls in a bit with your questions for Buzz Bissinger. The numbers are 333-9455, or outside our immediate coverage area, 800-222-9455. What does Tony La Russa represent as far as the, when comparing him to some of these, the more, I guess, classic managers you look back in the last 30 years or so,
right.
Plus of baseball, you look at like Sparky Anderson, Earl Weaver, maybe, I know you mentioned Gene Mauch there, and I think
right.
one of the techniques that La Russa
right.
kind of stole from him. Where does he fall in with some of the greats in recent years?
I think what's interesting about Tony, he has a foot squarely in both camps. He's very proud of the appellation baseball man, although it's become almost a derogatory term in some places because of the very interesting but very provocative book, Moneyball. Tony will be the first to tell you that all managers, good managers, steal from other managers. You know, they communicate with each other, so it's kind of a legal theft. And Tony, you know, as he was coming up as a not a very good player in the 1960s, you know, did worship at the altar of Gene Mauch and Dick Williams, who he played for briefly when Tony was with the Oakland A's. When he was a very young and frankly terrified manager in the 1970s, he learned a tremendous amount from Sparky Anderson, the great manager of the Reds, and then the Tigers. Of seminal influence in Tony's life was Paul Richards, who managed the Baltimore Orioles and was the first, way before it became in vogue, to put pitchers on a kind of 100-pitch pitch count. You know, Tony says Tony loved talking to these guys, and I think one of Tony's strengths, and it's contrary to perhaps to what people think of him from afar because he seems so utterly unapproachable and frankly miserable in the dugout, Tony is a really, really good listener. And when he was a very young manager, his first club was the White Sox, and the legendary Bill Veeck owned the team. And after every game, Bill insisted that Tony and the general manager, Raleigh Heedman, and then visiting scouts and the opposing team manager all come up to the barge room, which was kind of this stinky, colorful hole in the ground in old Comiskey Park. And Tony said it was like getting your PhD in baseball. He would sit and just listen. You know, they would debate the hit and run. They would debate when to sacrifice, you know, when to bunt, when to play the infield in. And this is how Tony grew up. But he's not a dinosaur. You know, he does believe in statistical analysis. He's obsessive about matchups between pitcher and hitter. He may be too obsessive. His pitching coach, Dave Duncan, is very computer literate and studies computer data constantly. And I think that's what have made the Cardinals successful. Tony is a traditionalist in terms of if you play the game right, it's meant to be played right. He cares about fundamentals. He likes putting on hit and runs. He particularly liked the suicide squeeze this year, but that's a very, very finely run team with guys like Dave Duncan and I think the most underrated executive in baseball, which is the general manager, Walt Jocketty, who is far more of a genius than the guys you kind of hear a lot about, like Billy Bean of the Oakland A's.
Then again, there are some moves that Mr. La Russa makes that I know I have some friends that are Cardinal fans and say that they get frustrated with him, and I guess that's the case maybe with any fan of the manager. He had the had Albert Pujols playing left field despite the fact that he had a very serious elbow injury that could have threatened his career and some other things like that.
You know, Tony is a risk taker. The rap against Tony is that he's a micromanager. He overmanages. Anyone who has watched the Cardinals play or watched the La Russa team, the game slows down when Tony's involved. He's constantly switching pitchers. He's an obsessive believer in using a lefty pitcher for one at bat. He once batted the pitcher eighth to kind of jigger with the lineup. When he was with the Oakland A's, they actually tried, instead of having one starting pitcher, they would have three teams of three starting pitchers in each game, one guy going three innings each. That didn't work. He made a very risky decision with Albert Pujols, and that's in the book. Albert's elbow was killing him. He really could not throw. Tony felt, and this was as early as April, the Cardinals were desperate. They had terrible pitching that year. The lineup was not working well, and he decided, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have Albert play left field and gave him instructions, kind of amazing, not to throw. If a ball came his way, he basically shuttled it either to the center fielder, Jim Edmonds, or to the shortstop at that time, Edgar Renteria. And you're exactly right. I mean, the danger was, Albert is an aggressive baseball player. He gets the ball, and the guy's coming around third trying to score, and Albert's going to wing it. And it could have been a career-ending injury. But as a writer, that's what you want. I mean, Tony, is whether you like him, and a lot of people like him, and whether you hate him, and some people hate him, and he can be frustrating and stubborn, he's bold and he's risky and he's complex as a man, and at least there was an attempt to convey that in Three Nights in August, that this is a very, very complex man and a game that doesn't necessarily lend itself to intellectual complexity.
Well, you talked about how a lot of people don't see him approachable, and you see him on baseball broadcast in the dugout, and this is a level of intensity. You also talk in the book about how his family is 2,000 miles away, and he might see them twice during the season. But it would appear to me that might be for the best, the way this man takes every loss and is just, it's very, very caught up in the game and the entire season.
Well, I think we all fashion the kind of existence that we need to have, and I think Tony has a good marriage, and he's an adoring father to his two lovely daughters. But Tony is very intensely wrapped up in his team, in the game. I think as he gets older, I saw it this year, he handles the losses a little bit better. They don't eat at him, to the degree that maybe they did even in 2003, then again, the Cardinals have been playing really well. But Tony does live by himself during the baseball season. He's done that since he came to the Cardinals in 1996. When he left Oakland to go to St. Louis, his wife, Elaine, said, Tony, I just don't think there's any sense in my going with the girls. Because, I think it's a plaque in their living room over the couch that says, we interrupt this marriage to bring you the baseball season. And Elaine said, we're not going to go because we don't want to live in your shadow. And even when you're there, you're not there mentally. You're always obsessing about the next game, or you're worrying about what the media said, or you're fiddling with the lineup, and you take losses very, very hard. And this is the way they've fashioned it. And Tony doesn't see his family that much during the season. And I think one of the attractive qualities of Tony, I'm not saying I agree with the lifestyle, was in the book, his candidness in admitting the mistakes that he made in terms of priorities, particularly when he was a young manager with the White Sox. There's an incident in the book where Elaine got sick with pneumonia. The girls were very, very young. She had to be hospitalized. It was the first time that she was away from her children. It was early in May. The White Sox were playing terribly. Tony knew what he should do, which is go home and be with his kids, but he didn't. He sent his sister down, and he sort of chose baseball over family life and regrets it terribly and feels a lot of guilt. But this is the type of guy that Tony is, and he's not a hail fellow, well-met guy. He's not a great storyteller, although he actually can be very funny, and he's extremely considerate and a warm, sincere man, but you will not see that when he's in the dugout. You know, we've all seen it. Albert hits a grand slam home run. He's not smiling. You know, he's always on to the next pitch, and whether the score is 10-1 in his favor or 10-1 against him, he's always thinking ahead. And I think that's what's made him ultimately successful in a career that simply does not lend itself to a lot of longevity.
So, how did the coaching staff and players take to this? To you having carte blanche into the dugout and in the clubhouse and your presence during this series?
It was an interesting challenge. I like to do books in which I have access going in. I just think it makes for better reporting. I like to write cinematically. I like to just sit quietly and observe and then hopefully put those observations into print. In Friday Night Lights, I quietly observed a high school football team in Odessa, Texas, and a prayer for the city. I quietly observed a mayor of a big city, in this case, the city of Philadelphia, for 4 years. This was different because of who I was dealing with. You know, pro athletes, particularly today, tend to be unapproachable. They don't like the media. They don't like hanging around the clubhouse after a game is done. They're in many ways almost like suburbanites wanting to catch the 505 home. They're suspicious. They're distrustful. And so I had to tread carefully. You know, I had Tony's graces and bit by bit, you know, got the confidence of the coaches, because the intent of the book was never to do a kiss and tell. It was not to sort of skulk around and sneak up on people. The intent was to do a book about strategy, about the game. But for the first 3 months of reporting, I didn't approach a single player, and it was just because I was nervous. I wanted to get them at the right time. I then didn't want them to think I was a pain in the neck. I wanted to see that I was going to be here and making a sincere effort to do a book. And then I realized that the best way in to players is to talk about the game, because they really like talking about the game. They like talking about, you know, here's what I was thinking when I was trying to get that batter out. Here was what I was thinking when I went through that at bat. And that became a nice common ground for me and for them. And they realized, you know, this is not going to be necessarily one of these personality-driven books. And then they opened up. You know, it's not the fault of reporters. The baseball beat writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Joe Strauss, is a great beat writer. He's got a difficult job. He's on deadline. He's got to ask hard questions. You know, I didn't have to ask those hard questions, and players resent them, and I understand their viewpoint as well. You know, when you ask a pitcher, you know, how do you feel when he gave up the home run in the bottom of the ninth? Well, how do you think he feels? He feels terrible. You know, he feels awful. And I didn't have to ask those questions, and I think my sense of access, if you're there long enough and the participants think you're committed, they will ultimately, or at least most of them will, you know, kind of come around.
We're talking with Buzz Bissinger about his book, Three Nights in August, Strategy, Heartbreak, and Joy Inside the Mind of a Manager. Discussing a three-game series. The book is framed around a three-game series between the Cardinals and Cubs played 2 years ago. What did this could be more a lengthy response, but what did you learn about the inner workings of a game, or even, you know, I guess maybe even an inning that you didn't know already? You're a longtime Yankee fan, or we're
right.
A Yankee fan anyway.
Right. We're.
Yes, I guess the Alex Gonzalez trade.
Right.
Rodriguez, excuse
right.
me. Change your mind about that. But what did you pull from this series that maybe you didn't know already?
Well, you know, there was a lot I didn't know. I mean, I have been a baseball fan all my life. I was a complete Yankees fan, and the Rodriguez trade just that was enough for me. I mean, I have a dear friend who's a religious Yankees fan, and like many Yankees fan, although she's a wonderful friend and a wonderful person, she is so Yankee-centric. She has no real awareness that there are other teams who actually play the game, and you hear a lot about how magnificent the Yankees were and what a great season it was this year, and it was a great season, but the fact of the matter is they have a payroll of $221 million. They got very, very lucky this year. They made terrible choices in buying players. They should win the World Series in four straight every year, given the size of that payroll. And when they got Rodriguez, I just felt it was just it terribly upset the chemistry of the team. I think it was a real knock to the ego of Derek Jeter, although he will never admit that. But in any case, I knew the game was complex, but it was until I got sort of in the dugout, in a sense, with Tony in the clubhouse, in his office, asking him hundreds of questions, I had no idea how complex it was. I had no idea, you know, how it does really change with every pitch. It was really fun to probe Tony's mind to see why he did what he did. And then I just had no idea about the preparation that goes into each game. You know, I always had, to me, the hardest act in all sports is hitting a pitch. And it's not necessarily 98-mile-an-hour fastball. You know, it's the movement that these guys, it's the way they change speed on every pitch and change location. I mean, I don't know how a hitter does it. So I always thought it was kind of God-given. You know, either you have the talent or you don't. And it wasn't until I saw the way an Albert Pujols prepares before every game and then actually during the game by going back into the clubhouse and looking at his at-bats. It's the way that Dave Duncan, the pitching coach, before every start sits down with the starting pitchers. And Dave has such beautiful, sharp eyes for baseball and his ability to find the holes in a hitter because of the charts he keeps and the computer analysis that he does is just phenomenal. And just, you know, he basically sits there, and it's just like a football coach. He outlines for the pitcher. They go through each hitter, and, you know, and it's pitch by pitch. Here's what you need to do on the first pitch. Here's what you do on the second pitch. Here's what you do on the third pitch. He really lays it out in meticulous detail, and it became clear to me that the biggest thing that differentiates one player from another is their mental willingness. You know, a lot of guys have talent, but the pitcher who listens to Duncan and takes his game plan and uses it and doesn't get rattled is going to be successful. And it's the same with hitting. Hitting requires tremendous concentration every at bat, every pitch. And that, to me, is why Albert Pujols is he's the most phenomenal baseball player of the past decade, and I think that actually includes Barry Bonds. Some may disagree, but just seeing the way Albert, he wants to get a hit every time, because you know what, hitters don't. Tony talks openly about this. They get two hits in their first two at bats, and they're done for the day, because it's exhausting. Tony talks very openly about how young players get spoiled by too much money, and he uses the almost the tragic example of J.D. Drew, who had so much talent coming in, it was ridiculous, but never has really cared about it to the extent that he can. I had no idea about the use of video. It's really revolutionized the game, and one of the great weapons the Cardinals have is a phenomenal video coordinator named Chad Blair. And Chad has never played organized baseball, but he's got an exquisite pair of eyes. So it's all these things, all this preparation that I think makes teams successful. And, you know, then Tony talked about beanball retaliation. That's a very significant chapter, and you know, once again, use names and real examples. It was just fascinating because it's something that a manager almost never, ever, you know, talks about.
We'll welcome your calls for Buzz Bissinger at 333-9455 or our toll-free number outside the immediate listening area, 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about the mental aspect of the game, one person I wanted to bring up was Rick Ankiel. I saw this guy pitch at the AAA park in Memphis. And it made you want to cry because every other pitch was off the backstop. And now he's trying to make it as an outfielder, I remember hearing in spring training.
He actually did fairly well, you know, given that he really didn't grow up as a hitter. But he's, you know, it's been a hard, hard slog for Rick. And it's, you know, that's what the book has in it. Is it's not just strategy. It does sort of, you know, veer in and out into kind of pivotal moments in Tony's career, although it's decidedly not a biography. There's virtually nothing in about Tony's playing career. But Tony, you know, off the field, in a sense, has been involved, I think, in two of the greatest tragedies ever. One is what happened to Rick Ankiel, the phenomenon left-handed rookie pitcher, and the other is the death, tragic death of pitcher Darryl Kyle. I don't think anyone will ever be able to pinpoint what happened to Rick, although I think it's a fear that every athlete has. It's a fear that I have as a writer, maybe you have as a radio host. You know, you just wake up one day and you've forgotten how to do it and you can't get it back. For those who remember, Rick Ankiel was a incredible left-handed rookie pitcher for the Cardinals in 2000. People who saw him said he had the stuff that came close to Koufax. He had a great fastball and a really good off-speed stuff and was working on a change, and he had maturity. And then, you know, Tony made a move that, you know, he doesn't take back, but I think in the recesses of his mind, he agonizes over. He decided to start Rick, who was still a rookie in the first game of the playoffs against the Atlanta Braves. And Ankiel self-destructed for reasons that no one understands. He threw five wild pitches in one half inning. He had been wild before, but certainly never that wild. It was freaky. It was weird. It was unsettling. Tony felt the best way to get over it was to bring him back out. He brought him back out in the NLCS against the Mets, and he lasted a half inning. I think he hit a batter or came close to hitting two others, and that was it. He has never been the same since. He would have occasional streaks of brilliance and then these awful, hideous streaks of wildness, and finally quit pitching altogether this spring training and is now trying to make it as a hitter. And no one knows why it happened, although Tony's theory, I think, is an interesting one. For most of his rookie season, he had Mike Matheny behind the plate. Mike Matheny, who's now with the Giants, is maybe the best ball blocker ever. He's a phenomenal defensive catcher, so he was able to get to a lot of wild pitches that Ankiel was throwing. Right before the playoffs, Matheny cut his thumb with a hunting knife that he had gotten as a birthday gift. He couldn't catch. They had to use another catcher who had a bad back. He could not get to the balls the way Matheny could. And Tony speculates that maybe for the first time ever in his life, Ankiel consciously had to think about doing something that had once been so automatic, and in consciously thinking, overthought, sort of lost the kind of seamless, God-given talent of what he was doing and has never, ever gotten it back. And, you know, it will always be a mysterious, terrible, unexplained tragedy.
We have a caller on their cell phone calling from Bloomington. Good afternoon. You're on the air with Buzz Bissinger.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the conversation this afternoon. It's kind of a post-mortem on the season. I also am a long-suffering Cubs fan, so I appreciate the overview. Got a couple of comments, and then since I'm on the cell, I'll go ahead and hang up in case your guest wants a comment. It did strike me, especially being a Cubs fan, the ability of some teams and some managers, not necessarily to win a championship every year, but at least to repeat finishing with winning seasons. And that is just something, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I don't know if the stars aligned and Chicago was so close, but you look up every year, year after year, in baseball you see St. Louis, and not necessarily this year, but in football you see, you know, the Green Bay Packers somewhere up there. And I don't know if it's something that's just not meant to be cosmically in Chicago's background, but we're just hard-pressed to repeat. The other observation I had, I'm 50, and I was listening to a Cubs game here not too long ago, and you mentioned about the money, and I think the money is just so fantastic. The need to succeed is so automatic. They said, I think there was one or two Cubs players that's currently playing on this team that, you know, was around 2 years ago or 3 years ago when we almost made it. And that's something, you know, going back to the 69 Cubs or whatever, you know, you had that infield memorized. Those players came back year after year after year. Yep. And I guess now, because of the dollars involved, you know, the success has to be almost immediate. And if it's not, you know, they're discharged and they moved on. And one other quick observation, I can remember baseball back when there were doubleheaders. And going back to Old Comiskey Park, they actually had, between the game, the father and son game on TV televised between the doubleheaders. And now that just seems so archaic because of the TV time and the money and the expense, and the players, as you mentioned, are much more distant. And it's just a sad state of affairs. I think we've lost a little bit of that. But anyway, I enjoying the conversation. If you had any thoughts, thank you.
Well, I think the caller wonderfully articulated a lot of points. I can't really understand what has happened to the Cubs. I thought a lot about the Cubs when I wrote this book. As Cub fans know, 2003 was an incredible year for the Cubs. They literally came within a pitch away of going to the World Series. We won't forget Stephen Bartman is long as we live. I guess what's puzzling to me about the Cubs, I don't believe in curses. I'll tell you, their pitching on paper is phenomenal, and I saw it in 2003. Mark Pryor, I thought, was going to be the best pitcher in the game. I mean, he was phenomenal. Kerry Wood I think the worst thing that may have happened to Kerry Wood was striking out those 20 batters. He's never come close to it. I don't think he's ever won 15 games, or maybe he's won 15 games once. He's always been snake-bitten by injuries, but he was good that year, and the best of the trio that year was Carlos Zambrano, who's been phenomenal. And then you add in Maddox. On paper, that should be a competitive team. One of the problems the Cubs have had that they haven't been able to overcome, they're just too aggressive at the plate. And the book on the Cubs was they'll swing at everything on the first pitch. And that's going to give a tremendous advantage to a team because it means you're not going to work the pitch count against the pitcher. If the ball isn't playing, it's on a home run, three-quarters of the time, the fielder is going to get to it. They've never solved their closer problems. And I think, look, it is a numbers game. Teams that are successful, it's not just the manager, it's the manager, it's the front office, it's the general manager, it's knowing where to spend the money. And, they took a shot on Garcia Parra, and maybe it wasn't the right shot, and, they got into a bind with Sammy. That wasn't their fault, but to get rid of Sammy, they had to eat a lot of his contract. The Cardinals, I think, in particular through Jocketty, have become very adept. They have a particular philosophy. We will pay big money to kind of five or six core players that we want to keep for 5 or 6 years. And you throw in three pitchers, so that's about eight players. And then Jocketty, in conjunction with asking Tony and other coaches, is really good at kind of bottom fishing and toning out the roster with guys that none of us have ever heard of but have made a tremendous contribution this year. Someone named So Taguchi. I would say 99% of people in baseball didn't even know there was anyone named So Taguchi. But So is from Japan. He's a terrific fielder. He's beautiful fundamentally. He's good in the clutch. They got Nunez, picked him up for nothing from Pittsburgh, and that's what you have to do. And the Cardinals have been very adept at it, and they give up something. They cannibalize their farm system. They don't have a very good minor league system. They'll make trades for established players, but I think it's served them well. I don't think the Cubs, in a sense, have kind of a sort of rigorous, philosophy. I don't know what's going to happen to Dusty. I think Dusty has been really good, maybe up until this year, of corralling the egos in the clubhouse and doing a good job with that. But I have to be frank, Dusty as a game day manager is both baffling and serious, makes some terrible, terrible moves. In particular, when he used that pitcher, their new closer Fox, in a 10-3 game and a throwaway game, and he blew out his arm, and there was just no reason to do that. And I think that's almost when the Cubs just started sliding downhill.
We could talk about these kinds of things for hours.
Sure.
Speaking with a Cubs fan, what players represent your origins with baseball when you were a Yankee fan and tickets were and hot dogs were a lot cheaper?
Yeah. I grew up in an interesting era. I mean, I am 50 years old, so I did get a taste of the great Yankee teams. I loved Bobby Richardson. He was so selfless and so silky smooth at second base. I love Tom Tresh because he had a great name. Elston Howard was magnificent. Mickey Mantle, Al Downing, Whitey Ford. But the game was different then. I could The Yankees went south pretty quickly as I got older, so then it became a keystone combination of Horace Clark and Gene Michael. You know, no one went to the games. The Yankees drew under a million people, but there were doubleheaders. It was just fun going out to a ball game. It's a much slicker production now. But I think I did grow up in the era of, some say it was in many ways the best baseball era ever, just, you know, the Hank Aarons and the Willie Mays and the Roberto Clementes. And I remember, you know, bleeding and literally crying when the Yankees got swept, embarrassingly swept by the Dodgers in 1963, you know, when they had Koufax and Drysdale and Padres. And my father was a tremendous Yankee fan, and, you know, would talk about seeing Joe DiMaggio, and I think he may have even seen Babe Ruth. I mean, seeing Jimmy Fox, and my uncle was a huge Yankees fan, and my grandfather was a huge Yankees fan. So the game was really, really, you know, in my blood. I will never forget. I went to a World Series game in 1964 against the Cardinals, and the Yankees went up 3-0, and I was giddy. And, you know, then my favorite player makes an error to load the bases, and then Ken Boyer hit a grand slam. And it was just one of the worst moments of my life, and that was it. The final score was 4-3. And, you know, do those types of players exist today? I think Albert Pujols is a legitimate throwback to those guys. You know, it is about the winning for Albert. He has not been spoiled by the big money, but a lot of these guys have, you know, like a J.D. Drew, who's just magnificently talented, but just as Tony says in Three Nights in August, you know, it's just too easy for him and for others to coast along on 75% of their talent. You know, it was interesting in writing about Rick Ankiel, you know, the point was not just to write about Rick, but, you know, Tony brought up the example of Pryor. You know, Pryor was kind of punky even in 2003. He was outspoken. He was cocky, and Tony didn't really like Pryor. He didn't like him because he was really good, and Tony's competitive, but it was almost like he was offering sort of a little piece of advice to Mark, which was, you know what, keep quiet. Don't make a big stink about yourself because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And if you want proof of that, go ask Rick Ankiel. And as you know, he's been hurt a lot. He's had a very kind of up-and-down career since he went 18-6.
Care to weigh in on how the Cardinals and the other teams will fare sure. in the postseason?
Well, yeah, I always love to weigh in. Just don't. If this is recorded, please don't play it. You know, if I turn out to be completely wrong, I'm sort of thinking, and I don't know why I think this. I see a Cardinal Red Sox World Series. Having said that, I think it's completely up for grabs this year. I think what makes me excited about the Cardinals this year is that I think in some ways for the postseason they're built better for this year than last year because they just have a better pitching staff. You know, last year they didn't have Chris Carpenter or Mark Mulder. They much have a much stronger 1-2, and that's what you really need in the playoffs. Their hitting is not as good, but, you know, so much of the postseason is about pitching. What worries me about the Cardinals is that neither Mulder nor Carpenter pitched well down the stretch. And, you know, the Cardinals haven't had a tough game in 6 months. And I think there's a reason wild card teams end up winning the World Series now is because they really peak at the right time and they're used to playing must-win games. The Red Sox, I'm going to contradict myself, if there is one team that can get by on just pulverizing the ball, it's the Red Sox. But, you know, if the World Series is the Astros and the White Sox, it won't surprise me. I think you could argue on paper the most formidable team are the Astros because they have by far the three best pitchers out there. And they have two of them are seasoned professionals who know what it's like to pitch in a World Series. And that's obviously Roger Clemens and Andy Pettit. And then they have Ray Oswalt, who's a wonderful pitcher. They have a great closer in Lidge, and, you know, they don't have to score a lot of runs to be successful. But, you know, I don't want to jinx the Cardinals, and I realize I've said this, and the wrap on the Cardinals is they can get tight. You know, kind of Tony is not the kind of guy who relaxes. It's hard for him to relax, but as, you know, part of Three Nights in August, the epilogue is about last year's World Series, and you know, I know Tony, and Tony agonized, and we'll think about ways to improve. And he said, you know, I got what I think it was a really good piece of advice from Joe Morgan, who was in a lot of World Series, and said, you know, when I get to the World Series, I don't want a lot of information. I don't want a lot of preparation at that point. I just want to know what kind of fastball does the guy have, and when does he go to his off-speed. That's all I want, because there's going to be enough pressure on me already and enough exposure, because it is the World Series.
Well, and you can look at statistics and computer analysis, but it only goes so far. Like you said, you have no – it could be the – the Padres and gosh, I don't know who would be the most unlikely AL opponent. Maybe the White Sox, because of just lack of experience.
You know, nothing would surprise me this year. I mean, there really hasn't been any this kind of dominant team. You know, and it could be. You know, look, it's a short sprint, and that the first round is a really short sprint. You know, it's five games where you really only need arguably you can get by on two pitchers. You know, Jake Peavy could steal that first game, and you know, anyone who goes up 1-0. That's a big advantage in the divisional playoffs. The Yankees, I don't know. I mean, I can't believe they got in, given the pitching staff. You know, Aaron Small. You know, he never won a game in the major leagues. He won 10 in a row. You know, Chacon, Mussina's hurt. You know, Randy Johnson is Randy Johnson, but he's not pitching nearly as well as he did 3 or 4 years ago. But they are the Yankees, and they're on a crest of momentum. I wish the Cardinals had been in the divisional race and had to win some games, and they haven't. They haven't had to win a game really since June. And you know, that can make a team. They'll never play soft, but you know, it's how you react to pressure is such an important component of how you do in the playoffs.
Well, now that you've discussed the inner workings of a three-game series during the Major League Baseball season in a very big rivalry, I mean, what sport would you like to tackle next?
Well, I'm not a sports writer by trade. I mean, I do like obviously writing about sports. I sort of, you know, I like writing about subcultures. I like sort of, you know, burrowing underneath the surface and see what I can come up with. I don't know what my next book will be. I'm working on other stuff now. I have a background as a television writer. I worked for NYPD Blue for a year, and so I'm working on a television script for a possible pilot, and then I'm also working on a screenplay. My next book may be about sports, or it may not. So I can't say, all right, now I'm going to write about basketball, or I'm going to write about pro football. I just don't know. I mean, I use as my guide, you know, what I feel inside myself, and I'm always looking, you know, for the narrative of a great story, and then just being able to you know, report the hell out of it when I get it and when I find it.
We just have a minute left. Any parting thoughts on what you would like someone to come away with from Three Nights in August, as far as maybe learning some things about baseball?
Well, you know, I think, look, the book has been a delightful success. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 20 weeks, which is amazing, because there are a lot of great books out there. And it's a very, very competitive market. The comments that have been most gratifying to me is, you know, people who don't live in the Midwest or aren't fans of the Cubs or aren't fans of the Cardinals, who simply have read the book and say, God, this is just a great book about the game. And I think that's what I want people to come away with. You don't have to be a Cardinal fan. You don't have to be a Cub fan. You just have to be a fan of baseball and just appreciating all the wonderful nuances and subplots of it. And, you know, it's my intent, and I hope I succeeded in sort of bringing you into this kind of almost off-limit subculture world and how it exists and why a manager does what he does and you know, all the strategy that goes in the game. But not just the strategy, kind of the beautiful, exquisite humanity. Because, you know, there's a lot that's said now about the only key is to analyze statistics and this and that, and all you need is a really smart computer. But that's not true. What's great about sports, what's great about life, what's great about baseball are all the human ingredients that no computer can ever quantify, and I think that really comes out in Three Nights in August.
Buzz Bissinger has been our guest. He's the writer of Three Nights in August, Strategy, Heartbreak, and Joy Inside the Mind of a Manager. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
It's 1:50. You're listening to WILL Urbana. We're now going to check in with Todd Gleason. He's got the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. Good afternoon, Todd.
Good afternoon to you, Jeff. Hey, a quick reminder for all those listeners out there that we are in the midst of the harvest season, and if you're on the back roads of Illinois or Indiana or any parts of the Midwest, you need to be watching out for slow-moving vehicles, combines, tractors, trucks even move pretty slow when they're fully loaded with grain. So keep an eye out for those. They'll be on the back roads. They'll be on the highways, too. And if you're watching out for them, I know they'll watch out for you. It's a very dangerous time of the year, and we want to make sure that everybody stays safe. Let's take a look at what happened at the Chicago Board of Trade, the Mercantile Exchange, coming up with the numbers from the board on the soft red winter wheat side of the pits. December contract today had a high of 352, the low at 345 and a half. Their settlement price, 348 and three quarters. They were up 2.5 cents. The March contract, 364, the high, the low at 358 and a half. A settlement price at 362 and a half, a penny higher. May contract, 370 and a half, the high, the low at 366. Settlement price at 369 and a quarter, up three quarters. In July, 376 and a quarter, the high, the low at 371 and a half. Settlement price at 374 and a quarter. They were up three quarters. September futures up three quarters as well, 381, the high, the low at 377. Settlement price there, $3.80 and a quarter cents for that September wheat contract at the Chicago Board of Trade, up three quarters of a cent. Now the corn pit, December futures, 209 and a half the high, the low at 205, settlement price at 208 and three quarters. They were up 3 1/4 today. March futures, 222 the high, the low at 217 and a half. Settlement price, 221 and a half, up 3 3/4. In the May contract, 229 and a half the high, the low at 225 and a quarter. Settlement price at 229, they were up 3 1/4 on the day. July contract in the corn pit, 236 and a quarter the high, the low at 32. Settlement price at $2.35 and 3/4, up 3. In September futures, 242 and 3/4 the high, the low at 239 and a half. A settlement price at 242, up 2.5 cents. And the December contract, 251 and 3/4 the high, the low at 248. Settlement price for the December corn at 251 and a quarter. They were up 2 3/4. Couple things coming up during the closing market report this afternoon. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Grainfield Marketing out of Normal, Illinois. Commodity week was a very bearish commodity week from all four of the analysts that were on Commodity Week. If you didn't happen to hear that, you can go back and pick it up off our website. But if you just want to determine in one fell swoop, say bearish both corn and soybeans, and not exactly sure what to do with the wheat, as there may be some opportunity for the wheat at this point. But that's the way things landed, and we'll talk about that with Kurt Kimmel this afternoon, see whether he's bearish or whether he started to turn around on this marketplace yet or not. And we'll talk with the folks at the Andersons, find out how that pile out in the backside of the Andersons, which is a very large elevator here in Champaign County, is growing. It seems to be growing by leaps and bounds, and we're still just in the very early parts of harvest for Champaign County, and find out just whether they have some dump charges in place, how early the elevators there and other places are closing for the day. I know that many farmers understand what's happening, but we'll take a look, more complete look at that during the closing market report this afternoon, too. Now, December oat futures, 164 and a half, the high, low at 161 and a half, a settlement price at 162 and a quarter. They're up 3/4 for the day. The March oats, 170 and 3/4 the high, the low at 167, and a settlement price at 167. They're up 0.5 for the day. We'll also hear from Daryl Good this afternoon. November beans, 586 the high, the low at 566, settlement price at 581, up 7 3/4 for the day. January futures up 9 1/4, 596 and a half the high. Low at 577, a settlement price there at $5.92.5, up 9 1/4. March futures 604.5, the high, the low at 585.5. Settlement price 599.5. They were up 8 3/4 in the May contract. 609, the high, the low at 591.5. Settlement price at 604.5. They were up 7.5 cents. July contract in the bean pit 614, the high, the low at 596. Settlement price at 611, up 7.5. And the August soybean, $6.10, the high, the low at 602, settlement price at 607. They were a dime higher. Bean meal futures, October contract, 169, the high, the low at 165. Settlement price at 167.30, up 10. December bean meal at 172.50, the high, the low at 168.30. Settlement price at 170.80. They were up 40. Wire service reports continue to insist that most of the gains in the bean pit are driven by gains in oil. That was the case today. At least they did have gains. 24.70 the high, the low at 23.50 for the October. bean oil and a settlement price at $24.46. They were up 74. December futures at $24.98. The high, the low at $23.73. Settlement price at $24.65. Up 70. Ideas there, of course, that diesel will be supplemented with vegetable oil, including soybean oil, as the future comes to pass. And the price of diesel and crude and all those other energies continues to climb. Now, with a look from the at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, here's Celeste Quinn. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, Todd. Good Monday afternoon.
We're a little tongue-tied, but we're working on it.
Okay, well, it's Monday, first weekday. And let's take a look now at what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. Prices higher. October feeder cattle, 116.60 the high, the low 115.20, the settlement 116.52.5, that up 110. November 115.62.5, the high 114.50, the low 115.40, the settlement, that finishing up 45. January 112.75 the high, 111.75 the low, 112.67.5 the settlement, that up 40. October live cattle 89.37.5 today's high, the low 88.75, the settlement 89.22.5, that up 10. December live cattle 90.45 the high, 89.80 the low, 90.22.5 the settlement, that up 22.5. October lean hogs, today's high 68.45, the low 67.30, the settlement 68.22.5, that up 102.5. December 65.35, the high 63.45, the low 65 even, the settlement, that up 165. February lean hogs 67 even, the high 65.35, the low, the settlement today 66.85, that up 167.5. And April lean hogs, the high 66.35, the low 64.80, finishing at 66.27.5, that up 187.5. February bellies, the high 92.55, the low 90 even, the settlement 91.80, that up 152.5. The Dow is off 23 points at 10,546. The NASDAQ up 7 at 21.59. The S&P 500 down 1 at 12.28.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Bezdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're tuned to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Henry Frayne is our technical director today. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. Coming up tomorrow here on the afternoon magazine, in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll take a look at health care in our final years of life. Our guest will be Dr. Joanne Lynn. She says health care and community services fall short of the needs of people who face a prolonged period of progressive illness and disability before death. Lynn is the author of several books on palliative care, including Sick to Death,